I think a lot of people get caught up in the emotion of the song, the tune, the fact that we're doing this corporately, and we don't really think about in that moment what we are singing. And life collide. We're going to be discussing anything and everything that you'll be facing in the world today after the sermon. My name is Jeremy Lundmark, and you're listening to episode number 57. I want to kick things off by sharing the winner of episode 56's giveaway. There were two John Piper books that were given away to Jeffrey Perry. He's already received those. And Jeffrey, thanks for listening and thanks for tweeting out what you're doing after the sermon. This week, I'm going to be giving away the book Disciplines of a Godly Family by Kent and Barbara Hughes. A couple of weeks ago, I gave away a companion book called Disciplines of a Godly Man. This is Disciplines of a Godly Family. I hear both of these books are excellent books. I've never read either of them. I probably should. But again, I'm giving away these books because they've been sitting on my shelf. They actually got packed into boxes and now they're just sitting down there. So I'm pulling them out one by one just to give them away to you and get the best use out of them. I think this week what I'll do is, again, have you share what you're doing after the sermon. Just take a quick snapshot of what you're doing. You can do that either Wednesday night, Sunday night, or you could do just a general picture of what you do after the sermon. Be sure to tag after the sermon. I'll also include anybody who tags or shares the episode and lets me know. So I'll put you all into a drawing. We'll do kind of a smorgasbord of a giveaway. So you can tweet out what you're doing after the sermon. You can share the episode with somebody intentionally. You could just tweet out after the sermon, do a mention, something like that. Any of those things will get you involved in this week's giveaway, Disciplines of a Godly Family. Just be sure to let me know that you've done it. Tag me, tweet me, direct message me. Just show me that you've participated. We'll get you entered into that drawing, and we'll announce the winner in episode number 58. Now I want to jump into a few things that are a little bit lighter. First, I want to talk about Crystal Pepsi. You know, in the past, I've talked about soda drinks, comparing different types of drinks, and a couple of weeks ago, I just had the opportunity to try Crystal Pepsi, and I gotta tell you, I had Crystal Pepsi growing up. It's kind of a funny story. My brother and I used to ride our bikes to the mall, and our first experience with Crystal Pepsi was primarily free. We would go to the mall, and they had this huge setup, because if you remember anything about Crystal Pepsi in the 90s, they really pushed hard to get this out there, and it failed miserably. It's one of the reasons we haven't had it for like 20 years, or a little over 20 years, I think it is. So my brother and I would go down to the mall. We'd ride our bikes. There was a comic store. There was also a baseball collector card store. We would take cards down there. We would do that kind of a thing. But we'd take this bike ride, and the guy there, the promotional guy, was giving away free Crystal Pepsi, and I gotta believe, I'd have to ask my brother to be sure, but at least 2-3 weeks straight, we went in the summer, rode our bikes to the mall, and got free Crystal Pepsi. And, you know, there's been this big push to get Crystal Pepsi back on the market. A little while ago, they sent out a couple cases to a few people who entered a drawing or something. There was some sort of way to get it. And they just re-released it. And I think the only way you can get it is in 20-ounce bottles. And I caught the link that said you could get it. And I'm like, well, where is it? And I couldn't find it at my local Walmart. And I waited a couple days after I heard that it was out. And went online, went on my local Walmart, and it said it was in stock. And I'm like, I gotta find this Crystal Pepsi. I gotta know if it tastes like what it used to, how I remember it. And so I finally did find it. And the thing is, you're not gonna find it in like the section, at least in my Walmart anyway. It wasn't where the soda and all the drinks are. It's actually in one of those, at least at my Walmart, there was one little mini fridge. You know by the aisles how they have those halfway, they're like, I guess they're like 2.5-3 feet tall fridges with Pepsi, Coke, whatever, usually specific. One mini fridge that had all Crystal Pepsi, and I found it, got a couple bottles, tasted it, and I gotta tell you, I like it better than regular Pepsi. And it's exactly as I remember it. Now, if you've never had Crystal Pepsi, then you might go, eh, whatever, no big deal. In fact, to me, it's not a great taste. I'm not surprised that it failed initially, but I'm also not surprised that it has a huge fan base because it is better. I think it is better. It goes down a lot smoother than regular Pepsi does. I don't feel like it's, I guess the best way to describe it is as carbonated or as bubbly. But it does go down a lot smoother, and it feels a little bit sweeter to me. I don't know, maybe different people would have a different feeling on it. But I did get the chance to try Crystal Pepsi. Was really good, was exactly as I remembered it. So if you get a chance to find Crystal Pepsi, I'll tell you how I found it. I went onto Walmart.com, typed in my zip code, and once you make your local store, you can find out where Crystal Pepsi is closest to you in stock. You can only get it in stores, and I think they're only selling it in individual 20-ounce bottles. You can't get like a 6-pack or 8-pack of them. They're only selling them in individual bottles for a limited period of time. So if you want to try Crystal Pepsi, I highly recommend it. If you had it as a kid, I think you'll agree with me. It tastes exactly the same. They haven't adjusted it at all. Exactly as I remembered it. If you've never had it before and you do try it, let me know what you think about it. I'm curious to know what people who've never had Crystal Pepsi think about it as sort of a new product to them. That'd be interesting to hear. But I give it 2 thumbs up. I think Pepsi should try to keep it on the shelves in a limited market. I think it does taste good, and I think there's a huge fan base for it. So kind of a cool thing. I also wanted to talk a little bit about something I've been playing around with on my computer, and for those of you who aren't geeky, technology savvy, you may want to skip about 5 minutes here and jump to the next segment, because I want to talk a little bit about operating systems, and I've been playing around for a long time with Ubuntu. It's actually a Linux build of operating system, and off and on throughout the years, I've tried to play with it and see how it works, and been going back and forth with it. And about a year ago, I had to, when Windows 10 came out, I had to make a switch on a desktop computer that I used for like 5 years. It was a desktop computer that came pre-installed with Windows Vista. And when Windows 10 came out, for those of you who know how the Windows rollout happened, if you had Windows 7 or 8, you could update to Windows 10 for free. But if you had Windows Vista or earlier, XP, anything like that, you couldn't really upgrade, and it really put you at a disadvantage. They stopped doing the updates for XP, and honestly, for my desktop computer, which was a really powerful machine, Vista was working fine, except all the updates that were coming for Windows Vista had just jam-packed the 150-gigabyte hard drive, which was a small hard drive, but I bought it, you know, 5, 6, 7 years prior to Windows 10 coming out, so it was actually a pretty good-sized hard drive when it came out. But anyway, I decided to switch that desktop computer because of the hard drive space. I switched that to our TV computer, and basically we use it for Hulu, Netflix. We don't really do Netflix too much, but Amazon as well, Instant Video. And because I couldn't upgrade to Windows 10 with the Windows Vista machine, I decided to throw Ubuntu onto that machine. And I got to tell you, I've been playing around with it a lot more. Actually just installed a side-by-side, which is where you have both Windows 10 and Ubuntu on the same machine. And when your computer boots up, you just pick which one you want. I decided to do a side-by-side build to figure out a little bit more about it because I really love the way that it's laid out, and I do like the way that it works. The only problem I've had with it over the years, and I've done this, it seems like every 3-4 years I try to throw Ubuntu onto something and see if it'll work, and there's always a hang-up for me. Like, there's always something that doesn't quite work, and even with the build that I put on my desktop, I had some issues getting Amazon Video to run, and I recently figured out how to solve that problem, and it's actually a simple solution. If you install Ubuntu 16 on a machine, and you install the most up-to-date version of Chrome, you should be pretty golden. And what I've been doing on my laptop is I'm trying to get to the place where I can use Ubuntu exclusively for all my podcasting as well. Now, the reason for that is because Ubuntu uses a lot less system resources and really produces the same result, or at least I think it does. And one of the things I'm finding out is that when it comes to podcasting, there's some really neat features that podcasters might want to look into. And I'll tell you why I'm doing this. Ubuntu is a free operating system. You can get it, download it for free, burn your own disk, and install it on any computer. And if you have an older computer, if you're running Windows XP or you're running Windows Vista and you're trying to get into podcasting, or you just want to buy a cheap computer and use it for basic computing, Ubuntu is a pretty awesome solution. I mean, you can do pretty much all of your what would be considered, you know, Excel spreadsheet document work I found out with Windows OneDrive, you can actually do a lot of editing right there online through the web browser. Pretty much anything you would want to do, I would subtract from that video editing. I'm still working on a decent video editor for Ubuntu, but pretty much anything else you can do. So if you wanted to buy a computer exclusively for maybe your kids to do work with the computer, or maybe you want to, like I do here at the house, if you want a computer that's exclusively for watching videos and you connect it to a TV, Ubuntu is a great solution. And one of the things I'm trying to figure out is, can I make it a viable solution for podcasting? And there's two neat things I found out. Number one, you can download Audacity for Ubuntu, which is the program that I use for recording podcasts. But one of the neat things is, with an Audacity build in Windows, you have to go and download a special converter for MP3 files. You don't have to do that for the Ubuntu version. When you download Audacity, it can convert automatically to MP3 files, which is a really convenient thing, because when I do my conversion, I have to save everything to WAV and then do an external conversion from WAV to MP3 to get it into that nice MP3 format that we all like to download off of iTunes, etc., and use on our podcast catchers and things. Now, the other thing I found that's really neat is Ubuntu has a Skype recorder that is downloadable and is free and actually will record Skype calls. Now, I currently use, for those of you who are curious about how I do my interviews, I use a program, it's a paid program called Pamela, and it records pretty perfectly your Skype conversations. Well, the neat thing about Linux, Ubuntu, is there's actually a package you can download that will record Skype calls. So you can get Skype, Audacity, and a Skype recorder, which is pretty much everything you would need to put together a legitimate podcast. You can do interviews, record, convert to MP3, all on a machine that would be older and dated because you're using less system resources. So for those of you who are currently using Windows XP or currently using something like Windows Vista and you're looking for an alternative, don't rush into this. This is definitely something for people who are pretty savvy with computers. But once you get a basic install of Ubuntu on your computer, you can get away with quite a bit of stuff. So I would just highly recommend checking out Ubuntu 16 for those of you who are more tech savvy. And because of this tech segment, if you're interested in tech stuff, if you're interested in how Christianity and technology come together and work together, I highly recommend the Tech Reformation podcast. I don't talk about technology too much here on this program, but I've been having a lot of fun with Ubuntu, and I think some of you who are more tech savvy might have fun with it as well. But if you're interested in technology and Reformed theology and Christianity, there is a podcast out there for you. It's the Tech Reformation podcast. They're part of the Theology Mix podcast network. Here is an advertisement for their podcast.
Hello, I'm Ben.
I'm Craig.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Tank.
We are the hosts of the Tech Reformation, where the world of technology meets the worldview of Christianity.
In each episode of our show, you'll hear three ways we hope to help you consider the ever-growing presence of technology in your life.
In Tech You Should Know, we curate the seven most important things to happen in the last 7 days in the world of technology.
In Tech You Should Use, we'll feature one piece of technology that you can use to improve your life, your ministry, and your walk with the Lord. And we'll go in depth on what it is and what it does.
And in Theology from the Headlines, we seek to get the conversation started on major issues right in the intersection of technology and theology. From self-driving cars to social media, from artificial intelligence to internet mob justice, and from ad blockers to encryption, we discuss just about anything.
So grab your USBs and ESVs and join us in the Tech Reformation on our podcast every week.
Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite podcast catcher.
Now I want to talk about two articles I ran into over the last couple of weeks that have political ramifications. I think they're interesting to talk about in terms of where our culture is headed and how we face it as American citizens. But there was an article posted a little ways back on Fox News website by Newt Gingrich. It was an article that was written to talk about safety and the need for more policing or better policing in our communities. He was referring to, at that time, one of the police shootings that had happened in Chicago and was sort of launching off of that to the criminal statistics in Chicago, which are not fantastic, to make his case that we need safety in the United States of America. And he makes this statement. It's his closing statement of the article. He says this: "The right of every single American to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is one of our nation's founding principles. Without safety and security, these rights can have no real meaning. Safety is a challenge we can and must solve. We must solve it for all Americans. Now, I was really wrestling with this. I posted a poll on Twitter about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, just asking folks, is safety a right? Is it something we have a right to? Now, our Constitution guarantees, our Bill of Rights guarantees, that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The question is, can we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness while the government is the one ensuring our safety? And I've always had this problem with the government's idea of safety. I always feel like it's the way that government finds its way into overreach, to protect the American citizen, to help the citizen, to help the person. They overreach their responsibility and they begin taking from our liberties. And in the way I look at society, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, everybody has an opinion, so shoot it out there. But as I read this article, I thought, we don't have a right to safety. And I don't think that it's one of the government's primary jobs to keep us safe. Now, on a certain level, that's true, because there's certain roles that the military has and the police have to execute judgment against wrongdoing. That's a biblical role, and it's a biblical responsibility of the government. But to make sure I'm safe at all times is really not the government's responsibility, and it's one of the responsibilities that comes with the right of liberty. When we say that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we have that right, but we don't also get with that the right to do it safely. I don't have the right to drive my car safely to work every day, right? I have a responsibility, if I'm going to drive to work, to do so safely. But there's no way that the government can safely transport me to work every day and guarantee my safety unless they take away my liberty. And let me explain this to you. You see, we have in vehicles, and I love vehicles as an explanation for this, because vehicles are one of these things where the government really does try to overreach. And driving a vehicle is not necessarily a right in our nation. You have to have a license. You have to be allowed to do it. You have to be a certain age. But once you have that license, once you have that freedom, that liberty to do it, you then can transport yourself to work. And again, everything I just talked about right there is the government trying to keep us safe within the bounds of our liberty, right? Why can't somebody who's younger than a certain age drive a car? Why are there standards for people driving cars? Well, the answer to that question is it's unsafe for people of a certain age to do certain things. But what's interesting, I was able to drive a car at age 15. A lot of states have a standard of 16 or older, or permits that you have to get and you have to log a certain number of hours. Why? So we stay safe on the roads. And one of the objectives of the government is to keep these liberties safe. But at the same time, every time the government tries to reach in and to keep us safe, it finds a way to restrict liberty. And so in our nation, somebody who's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old can't drive a car. In fact, somebody who's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old can't even ride in a car unless they have a car seat. Why? Because they have to be kept safe. And one of the things that scares me about this whole safety movement, and we see it in a ton of different areas, is that it's always used to overreach. And some people would argue that whenever the government is trying to keep us safe, if it accomplishes that purpose in just one instance, then it's a good thing. But I don't think that it is. As we lose our liberty, for example, our Second Amendment rights, we lose the ability and the responsibility to keep ourselves safe. And when we talk about Americans' right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a part of that right comes the responsibility to do things safely, to protect oneself. Is it the government's job to protect me, or is it my job to protect me? Do I have the freedom to protect myself, or is it the government's job? And there's always this give and take with safety and liberty. And the more we give the government, some might argue, well, if you take too much liberty, then you're not safe and people will die and people will get hurt. That is the trade-off, and we're always trying to strike this balance in the United States of America. And in Newt Gingrich's article, he was calling for better policing and more policing, specifically as it relates to shootings and inner cities and the rising of crime rates. But what he's trying to guarantee, he can't guarantee. And everything that the government tries to do comes with all the same errors that we try to do ourselves. And So as I was thinking about this article and I was thinking about people voting, what we need to figure out in our nation is whether or not we want to be a free society where we have the freedom to make choices, or we want the government to keep us safe. And whether or not we trust people to do that for themselves, or whether they need the government. See, the irony of the whole thing is that the government is made up of people. And all the problems that come with protecting oneself come with the government trying to protect you. That's why you have police shootings. That's why you have issues with police brutality and police picking out different people and selecting certain races. Because just as I as an individual cannot keep myself perfectly safe by stocking up an armory and bombs and, you know, building an armory around my house and a wall around my house, I still can't make it perfect. And insofar as every person is incapable of being perfectly safe all the time, the government is incapable of keeping every person safe all the time. And one of the things that I struggle with is this need that the government has and that people have for being safe. And it seems good intention. And that's the worst kind of tyranny, the kind that seems like it's good, right? When the government is seeking to protect you, 9 times out of 10, it's overreaching to take away your liberties. Now, it seems like in the United States of America, by and large, we've said, okay, we will take this trade from liberty to safety. And I recognize that there has to be a balance. I don't think there's an either or, because I think in a society that has no government and a complete anarchy, people are left to themselves and bad people will reign. So you do need to have that role that God has given the governing authorities to bear the sword and to punish wickedness. But that role and that responsibility is not to keep us safe, it's to punish wrongdoing. Now, there's a certain degree to which the byproduct of that is a certain amount of safety, but at the same time, if we're going to be a free people, if we're going to have liberty in the United States of America, we have to understand that comes with a certain level of responsibility. And the degree to which we want the government to keep us safe, to me, that's the same degree to which we're going to lose our liberties and our freedoms. And I think everybody on some level is willing to give that up to a certain extent for the sake of that sense of security and that sense of comfort that I'm safe now. But the reality is, no amount of overreach of the government is going to produce any more safety than you would have otherwise. And a community organized together against crime and against these things would be just as effective as a federal government or a state government or a local government. And we have to be very careful in our nation that when we're trying to, whether it's an emotional appeal or whatever it is, when we're trying to save the children and protect people and help people and just saving one life is all it takes to make it worth it, we have to really measure that against the amount of liberties that we're losing. And I think there's a certain degree to which people are willing to give up liberty for that sense of safety. I think our country has, by and large, a lot of times said, yeah, this is one of those things that we think the government needs to keep us safe from. But we see that overreach when we see it in our health, like in New York State, where in New York City, where they tried to limit the amount of soda you could have. You can't protect people. The government can't protect people from themselves. It's that argument of should we have seatbelt laws and helmet laws? Well, some people say, well, if you just saved one life, it's worth it. But is it worth it? That's a question we have to ask. And there are some people who would say, yes, it is. I, for one, think that one of the questions we need to ask and one of the things that we need to start valuing is how much liberty is being traded for the safety that we're trying to get, and whether or not the safety that we're getting in that trade is really going to be the safety that we want. And one of the problems I had with Newt Gingrich's article is he's calling for more policing and better policing. But the problem is, police are men. They're men. And whether I'm trying to protect myself with the liberties guaranteed me by the Constitution, or I'm being protected by men in uniform, there's always that chance, that likelihood, because we are sinful men, that this is going to go wrong somehow. And we're going to need something else to protect us from that and that and that. And this always tends towards more government, not less. If we trust the government, which is made up of people, to protect us, we should equally be willing to protect ourselves and to trust local communities to do that job for themselves. Now, how we balance that in our theology, in our philosophy, is a great question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. How much should the government be involved with? Where does the push for safety infringe on our liberties too much? Or is there no extent at which the government can be restricted in keeping us safe? Should they have that full responsibility? What are your thoughts on that? To me, when I look at it, the more we lean on the government for protection and safety, the less we're leaning on God and the less we're leaning on individual liberty. And I think that's concerning. I'm more concerned about a government overreaching to the point where it becomes tyrannical than I am about individuals not being able to protect themselves and be responsible for their own decisions. Now, a related article that I read, and I'll have both of these articles posted in the show notes, was an article where they were talking about, I think it was London, England, is going to be putting together the first task force that will be dedicated specifically for monitoring and stopping online bullying. And the headline for the article was police task force dedicated to stopping trolls or something to that effect. And I had to laugh at the headline because I did a whole episode, not a whole episode, but part of my interview with Elijah T. from the Fetal Position podcast, also part of the Theology Mix Network. We did our episode, I think it was episode number 38, where we talked about trolling, and he has a really good standard. I highly encourage you to check out that interview where we talked about the importance of limiting the amount of responses you have towards trolls. And for those who don't know what the definition of a troll is, I'm not really sure I know what the robust definition is, but it's people out there who are on social media who have the sole objective of just causing trouble. And apparently London, England is putting together a task force that's specifically for policing this. And again, this sort of leans back towards that previous article I was talking about where here's the government trying to keep us safe from online predators. And there's a certain degree to where I look at this and I go, well, that's probably a good thing. Because I know there's been times when I was frustrated with Twitter because they wouldn't respond to certain things. I know there was one individual whose personal information was put out there. And it's like, there seems to be a line. There ought to be a line where that is punished. Now, obviously, the whole purpose of this, I think one of the main reasons is young people on social media do get bullied a lot. And it is a real problem where it does sometimes lead to suicide. It leads to bullying and abuse. And I think anyone, you know, that conversation I just had where, you know, we're willing to, if we can help the kids, you know, if we can help our kids be safe, then that's okay. But again, who should really be policing? Let's use young people, first of all, as our example. Who should be the ones policing that? Should it be the government? Whose role and responsibility should it be when a child is being bullied to take care of that? Shouldn't that be the parents' role? And hasn't God ordained a structure both in the family and at the societal level to where that could be punished? I think it should be punishable. I think there's certain degrees to where this gets so bad where it needs to be dealt with. But at the same time, if we're going to let the government get involved with this and start policing it, guess what's going to happen? You're going to start losing your Anon accounts. You're going to start losing a lot of people are going to start getting uncomfortable with how they use the internet, and they're going to stop using it, and we're going to have less freedom on the internet. And the internet is one of the few places where we do have quite a bit of freedom to say what we want. We have a lot of liberty, and it goes pretty well for the most part, except for these instances of bullying. And, you know, all it takes is one instance of bullying that leads to suicide that will lead people to say, you know what, we need to get the government involved here. And I know for a long time, countries have been looking for ways to regulate the internet. How do we tax internet purchases, and how do we regulate this monster that is the internet? And I think it's James White on The Dividing Line has said for a long time that he doesn't think that this medium will continue to be as free as it is. I did an episode with the Tech Reformation podcast that we just talked about where we discussed how free podcasting is. The door to entry, the entry level to get into podcasting is very low. It's not hard to get into this. And it allows us to have a voice and to speak into it. But with that comes a certain amount of responsibility and a certain amount of things that we don't want. There's all kinds of stuff out there for podcasting that you wouldn't want. But I thought it was interesting that London is putting together a police force, a task force for online bullying. And I'm curious to see how that will work. In my notes, I put it's like a different kind of troll. You've got the troll police. it's a different kind of troll. Like, they're out there trolling trolls. And I know some of us have all done that, where somebody comes in, gets into an argument just to pick a fight, and we always want to go back and forth. I do think a certain amount of policing needs to be done. I just don't think it's the government's job. I think businesses should be held accountable. I think those businesses should be responsible at a free market level to know when this is damaging to their community, whether the media picks up on it and puts it out there. They should be able to do that and do that well. And I know Facebook, Twitter get a lot of kickback when they do restrict things and limit things for religious reasons. So maybe that's the reason why it's easier for the police to get involved. But again, like I said with that previous discussion regarding safety, the more we let police government get involved with policing the internet, the less freedom we're going to have on there. And again, some people may look at that and go, hey, that's good. We don't need as much freedom as we have, and we use it to our own detriment. Totally true. But at what point are we going to be looking at that and going, maybe we let them get in too far? And I think it's the start of what I've heard guys like James White talk about, where we're going to start seeing more and more regulation in podcasting, in the internet airwaves, in video. Slowly and surely, we're going to see whether it's businesses using that police force, that government intervention to block people who are competitors, or it's just regulation put out there for the sake of safety to make it even harder for people to get their information out there. One way or another, I see this as leading toward less freedom, less liberty in the internet space. And since I mentioned Elijah T in this segment, I'll give a little bit of a promo here for his show. You gotta check out the Fetal Position podcast. Great podcast. Elijah's doing an awesome job just standing for the pro-life cause and doing it from both a Christian perspective as well as a scientific perspective. Here's a quick promo for the Fetal Position podcast by Elijah T.
Hello, my name is Elijah, and I am the host of The Fetal Position, which is a pro-life podcast dedicated to all the bioethics issues surrounding the life of the unborn human children, from conception to birth. We will be discussing issues from abortion to genetic engineering, stem cell research to cloning, and possibly a handful of afterbirth issues like organ donation and physician-assisted suicide. You can find more details at thefetalposition.com, and please join me in the discussion. Talk to you soon.
Now, I want to close this episode out by answering a question sent to me by Mullinist Max Headroom on YouTube, and I'll leave a link to the clip in the show notes. If you've never heard Mullinist Max Headroom, these clips are a little bit hard to understand, but I think you'll make it out. Here's his question sent to me through a YouTube video.
Hello, Jeremy. I am your biggest fan. I love the podcast. My name is Mole 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 Mist Max Headroom Room. And I have a question for you. It is about worship and CCM music. Is
it just me,
or do we allow theology in our music that we would never allow in our pulpits? Do you think there is a theology gap with our worship
leaders?
Or are we just more comfortable with singing some things than saying them? I would love to hear your opinion. And I would like to know if you are
team sloppy wet
Christmas or team unforeseen Christmas.
Now, I would answer that question by saying, first of all, and I don't mean this to be offensive, I just think it's generally true. I think the average Christian layperson sitting in the pew is really not thinking much about what they're singing when they're singing it. I think that we go to church, we open up the hymnal. If we don't know the song, we just sing it. And I think we're more in tune to the tune of the song or certain concepts that may emerge from the song than we really are about the song's content itself. Now, that being said, the authors certainly know what theology they're trying to input into the song, and I think there is definitely a distancing from deep theology to music today. When you look at the old hymns, and listen, I'm not an old hymns guy or a new music guy, but when you look at the old hymns, there's clearly an intention on the part of the author to develop a robust theological concept over the course of four verses and a chorus, where it seems like in more modern music, there's a desire to repeat a single truth over and over and over again. And the more that we are influenced by the music industry, there seems to be this tendency to want to generalize our songs so that they can be used both in the Christian realm as well as in the public sphere, the public arena. So I think we have a tendency to want to keep our songs convenient for the marketplace. I think that's just a reality. I think that's a balance that everyone has to play. But I think of a song like Our God is an Awesome God. I remember one of my professors in college saying that's one of his favorite songs, Baal is an Awesome God. He was an Old Testament professor, and he never understood that song because as popular as it was, anybody could sing that. Our God is an awesome God. Well, who's your God? It doesn't say anything about who God is. It just says, our God's an awesome God. And anyone can sing that about their God. And so he would joke, because he was an Old Testament professor, Baal is an awesome God, and sort of joke about that song. And I think this desire to appeal to both a secular and a Christian market has led to songs that lack deep theological conviction. And, you know, I think generally speaking, we don't pick up on it, as you said in your question. I don't think we pick up on it. When we're listening to a sermon, we're honed in on the text and what the person is saying. When we're singing, I think a lot of people get caught up in the emotion of the song, the tune, the fact that we're doing this corporately, and we don't really think about in that moment what we are singing. So I think that's a big problem that we have, and I think it requires the average church person, and particularly the leadership, when they're selecting songs to be used in worship, to be able to say, okay, what is the theology of this song? I don't think we can rely on the congregation to show up Sunday morning, songs show up on a projector screen for the first time, I've never seen them, and to piece that all together. Certainly people who are following it closely could do that. If they take the song home and research it, they'll be able to go, well, what's the theology behind this? Or this one line didn't quite sing right to me. Some people will pick up on that. But I think by and large, we are certainly happy to have theology in our singing that we would never have in our pulpit. So that certainly is a problem. And, you know, I think the solution to that is to get those people who are theologians in the same room as those people who are writing the music. What we're finding, at least in our culture, is that the music industry, I think, is driving a lot of how songs are constructed. And what I mean by that is I think there's a lot of influence from the market leading Christian producers and those who are not only writing these songs but actually putting them out there to make them fit radio, to make them fit the buyer. And so there's always that bottom line that's a problem, where when we look at the old hymn writers, certainly their objective was singularly to glorify God and to magnify him. So I'm sure the same types of things were pulling on them, but it's pretty obvious in our culture anyway that a lot of times the church is trying to follow the mainstream music movement. And even when we say we're trying to get ahead of it, I mean, I look at Lecrae and guys in the rap scene, so to speak, even when we look at them, they say they're trying to do things differently, but at the end of the day, it's still a certain genre that they're trying to appeal to. There's still a market they have to sell to. And I think that plays a big part in it. As to your last question, the sloppy wet kiss thing is ridiculous. So I'll just leave it at that, and I won't get into any further comment on that particular song. This concludes episode number 57 of After the Sermon. Remember, I'm giving away Disciplines of a Godly Family by Kent and Barbara Hughes. Feel free to tweet out the episode, mention the episode. Just make sure when you do that, you mention After the Sermon or Jeremy Lundmark. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to pick up on the fact that you did it. But let me know somehow that you shared it, retweeted it, whatever. I'll look at that in my notifications. Or another option is you can share what you're doing after the sermon, either in text or picture form. One way or another, I'll get you in. Just make sure you tag me in however you're sharing the program, and we'll get you entered in to win Disciplines of a Godly Family by Kent and Barbara Hughes. As always, I want to thank you for listening to After the Sermon. Sorry about the 1 week break there. We had a lot going on in the family, had a doctor's appointment, and had to meet with my pastor as well. So had a bunch going on last Monday. So thanks again for coming back and listening to episode number 57. Thanks for using up your data, your hard drive space, your energy, your time. Thanks in advance for sharing the episode. And as always, folks, we'll see you next week after the sermon.